In 1971, Clive Ford went to work for IBM as a systems engineer, following the footsteps of his father, John Stanley Ford, who had become the first black systems engineer hired by IBM in 1947. His memoir about his father's experiences, Think Black, appraises the racism and discrimination he faced as IBM's second black employee and the sacrifices he made to be a corporate trailblazer. Based in large part on several long conversations Clyde had with his father after he retired, Think Black also reveals the emotional cost of his father's experiences at IBM on his relationship with the author. Clyde Ford is the author of 13 works of fiction and nonfiction. Clyde Ford, welcome to KAZI Book Review.
Holton, thank you so much for inviting me on your program. I'm very excited to be here with you.
Clyde, I'm going to try to recapture the moment that we captured before I started taping, which is when you went to work for IBM in 1971, you were actually a rebel, quite the contrast of your father when he went to work for IBM in 1946.
That's right. I walked into IBM wearing a blue pinstripe suit, a bright red turtleneck, a huge afro, and what didn't get into the book is that I had on brown patent leather shoes with high heels.
I remember those days, early 1970s, when high heels were in. That was sort of the fashion statement we were all making. I was in junior high school at the time, and I recall how important those high heels were as a fashion statement.
Yeah, I think for men, they were called platform shoes.
Yes, platform shoes. Yes. Well, you know, that's quite an interesting way to approach IBM, because as I shared with you before we got on the air, I worked for IBM in 1979, and I was always told when I worked for them while I was in college at Xavier University in New Orleans that your clothes should not distract from the product. Now, you were going into system engineering just like your father did, but still, I would imagine your colleagues at IBM must have really thought you were different.
Yes. And so that first day, there was a man, actually a black man, after I had gotten out of my manager's office, and of course, it really flipped my manager out to see me dressed the way I did, but there was this fellow in my office who came over, sat on the edge of my desk, as though he were there as my teacher, and started to go down everything I was wearing and the way I looked. You know, he said things to me like, red turtleneck, lose it. White shirt, if you want to be different, try a blue shirt or a pinstripe tie. he pulled up his pants leg and he said, shoes, don't even think about it. Black or brown shoes, if you want to be different, try Oxford. And then finally, he looked at my hair and my pork chop sideburns, and he just shook his head and said, I just don't know what to tell you. Don't you understand that you're at IBM now? And I think what he didn't understand, and many of the people who first saw me didn't understand, is I knew very well that I was at IBM because my dad had worked there since 1946, before I was born, and I just wanted to make sure that IBM understood I might be coming to work for them, but I wasn't going to be like my father.
And one of the threads throughout your memoir is the conflict you have with your father. And not that different many times. The younger generation, we come along and we have different ideas on how we need to conduct ourselves. Now, your father was the very first black systems engineer hired by IBM in 1946. He was the second black employee. And your father found out that IBM was interested when his, I believe his accounting professor invited him over for dinner. She was a woman. His mother did not want him to go. This is the 1940s. Jim Crow still strong, alive, and well. And when he went there, there was a surprise dinner guest.
That's right. Out of the shadows came Thomas J. Watson, then the president of IBM. My dad didn't really expect that, and Watson said to my dad, a line my dad repeated often, he said, I'm the only damn person in this company who could ever hire you. Meaning, of course, that most of the people at IBM at that time, all of whom were white, would not look very favorably on a black man working for the company.
And your father really took this idea of representing his race seriously, and you say in the book that that burden was passed on to you. And so this was a time period in the 1940s where if you were the first black or the second black, one of the very few blacks working in any capacity where the vast majority of the employees or practically all of them were white, that you had a heavy burden that you had to carry as that employee.
Yeah, and so my dad, as the second black employee, the first software engineer in America, really, in IBM, you know, the burden was very similar to the burden that Jackie Robinson carried. And I make that comparison in the book. About the time my dad was hired, Jackie Robinson went into the Brooklyn Dodgers lineup, and there was a sense that every person of color to follow you would somehow be judged based on how you performed. And I think that was the burden my father carried, the sense that all of the black software engineers, the software engineers of color, to follow him would somehow be judged based on how he performed. Whether that was true or not, whether that has been true or not, I don't think that mattered as much as what mattered was the sense that it was true. And that was the environment, that was the community that my father grew up in. And in many ways, that was the heritage that he passed on to me.
And when you say that heritage was passed on to you, you talk about how as a visiting the IBM Country Club, you fell down. I think you were 4 or 5 years old, and so you got a little tear or maybe scraped your knee. And under normal circumstances, your mother would just say, it's okay, wipe it off and say, let's keep going ahead. But because you were going to the IBM Country Club, your father actually decided that you could not attend, that you were going to be sent back because of his focus on wanting to present the right image to IBM.
Absolutely. We were, my sister and I, my mother and my father, we were the representative so-called perfect black family. There could be no blemishes when we were around IBM. So a fall, a scrape, a little bit of dirt, I mean, that in a sense represented a blight on the burden of representing your race. I can say, I can tell you this, Hope, and I said it in the book, it's really almost impossible to conceive of that any one person could represent an entire race. And when you put that on the shoulders of a child who doesn't understand these larger issues, it's a real thief that steals childhood. And I can say that those times at IBM, I look back as not the happiest moments of my childhood, because there was a sense you just couldn't be free and play, that everybody was watching you all the time. And if you made any misstep, your father's career would instantly vanish. Whether that was true or not, that was how we grew up. That was the burden that we grew up with.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to KAZI Book Review on KAZI 88.7 FM. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest is Clyde Ford. He is the author of Think Black. And the cover of the book has a design that is sort of reminiscent of the IBM design, especially the word think, because think was the actual slogan of IBM that Thomas Watson brought to IBM, Thomas Watson Sr. And talk a little bit about your discovery of the issues your father had going to work for IBM, because one of the things that you share in the book is when you were going through therapy, you were your therapist challenged you to talk to your father about his experiences, and over the over 3 summers, you learned a lot about your father's experiences growing up, some of the challenges that he faced, and his experiences at IBM.
That's right. And one of the things that really sticks out in my mind, and I think helped me better understand how my father behaved at IBM, was the level of both personal and institutional racism that he faced. The number of people who wanted him to fail. The times, for example, when he was sent to a business meeting that turned out to be a meeting with a prostitute with the intent of catching him in a compromised position that would then force him to resign. So things like that made me understand, recognizing the times that my father started at IBM, late 40s and early 50s, before the civil rights movement, before anti-discrimination laws, before even the Brown versus Board of Education equal education laws. I mean, he started at a time when blacks in this country certainly were struggling against Jim Crow laws and other forms of racism in a very overt way. And here was my father doing the same thing in IBM while trying to keep his job. I also got from my father, and I heard him say so many times, a black man has to work twice as hard as a white man to be considered half as equal. And so I saw my father working not 40 hours a week, Hope, and I can tell you that. It was more like 60, 70, or 80 hours a week. He was always working on the weekends. He was working late in through the night, and he was working, you know, at times when I'm sure if he were not in that position, he might have been out playing ball with me or doing some of the other things that a father does with a son. So I think there was a trade-off that he had to suffer, that I certainly suffered, that was the result of him being the first black software engineer, both at IBM and in the country.
Now, there's a part in the book where you talk about he hid his stress well, but by the early 1960s, the stress of being the first black systems engineer at IBM had taken its toll. He now smoked cigarettes. He stopped exercising. He played the piano less, he gained weight, and most of all, he had a tremor in his right hand that became more pronounced. So you saw the physical manifestation of facing constant racial discrimination and racism by being basically by yourself in this instance, corporate America. I'm sure it, you know, affects your health. It affects your the longevity of your life. So you saw it actually in action.
I saw it in action. I hated what I saw happening to my father. And I think that as we're talking about this, I'm realizing that some of the decisions that I made in my own life are probably a result of seeing that in his life. So a decision to make sure that I never stopped exercising, a decision to make sure that my diet was really clean, a decision to get involved in yoga and meditation as forms of stress relief. I think I made some of those decisions personally because I saw the incredible toll that they took on my dad, who didn't have those tools at his disposal to work with.
Now, there was your father was a company man for a long time until he finally accepted the fact that after 16 years at a company where his advancement had been systematically thwarted, as you write, my father began to realize he was up against something much larger than he anticipated. And he put into motion his own plan to bring about change at IBM. And it appears that going to the March on Washington in 1963 was sort of the catalyst of all that had been pent up of him finally deciding that he has to take subversive action because going the corporate way was not going to work.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about that. And a number of things happened after the after the March on Washington. My father and my mother were both there on the mall listening to King speak from the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. And when they came back, my dad was a different man. I saw that both in how he acted in the world and also how he acted within the IBM corporate culture. In the world, I actually saw him, and this was so uncharacteristic of him. We were driving down south, and in those days when you drove south, you had to cross the Mason-Dixon line, and when you crossed the Mason-Dixon line, you were subject to Jim Crow laws. And so the Maryland House, which is still a stop on I-95, was a place you would often pull off to rest. And the years before that, it was actually where the bus for blacks only would be, and you would have to get on this bus. Well, one summer, we were driving in a car, so we didn't have to change buses, but we stopped at the Maryland House, and a waitress there would not serve us because we were black. And my mother looked over to my dad and said, Stanley, now's the time to take a stand. And they did. We were a family of one who did our own personal sit-in in a restaurant in order to gain service. And I look back now, and I'm really proud that my parents did that, although it was very uncharacteristic of my dad. Within the company, what I discovered during those times is that my dad had actually obtained copies of the IBM entrance examinations, which he was then selectively giving out to promising young black applicants to help them with the answers to those entrance examination questions, allowing them to get a foothold into the company where he had not been able to get a foothold. He had to train managers who became his manager. His promotions weren't given to him the way they normally would have been given to somebody who wasn't black. So I saw him running this underground railroad in IBM at the same time he was taking a strong social stance that something needed to change. So I can look back at that, as I said, with some pride and realize that my father did get to a point in his life where he realized enough was enough.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to KAZI Book Review on KAZI 88.7 FM. I'm Hopeton Hay. We're talking to Clyde Ford, discussing his memoir about himself and his father, Think Black. His father was the first black systems engineer hired by IBM in 1946, and Clyde himself joined IBM in 1971, but with a different perspective. Now, one of the big sources of conflict between you and your father, and it's really sort of a manifestation of self-hate, was his belief in the theories of the inferiority of black intelligence espoused by Charles Murray, author of The Bell Curve, and Arthur Jensen. And what's so ironic about this, here's your father. He is a classical pianist, extremely talented, extremely smart, but apparently bought into these theories of the lighter your skin, the more intelligent you are.
Yes, and I have to say, as I look back at that, it's a really tragic sense of what my father put himself through. My feeling is that my dad was probably looking for ways that might help explain why he wasn't getting the advancement that he deserved, why things weren't happening for him in the same way they were happening for others. And instead of pointing the finger outside and looking at all of the things in the outside world, one of the things he started to do was to turn in on himself. You know, we call this internalized racism. And it is a sense then that he was the problem. If only, and he would say this, if only his skin was lighter, then perhaps he would be more intelligent. And yet he was this incredibly intelligent person, not only playing chess, as you said, but a chess master, played several instruments, had succeeded in doing things in IBM that many people had not succeeded at. And so I really couldn't understand that. And at the same time, I was coming up in the post-civil rights age when black power was really important. And I just wanted to eat up and learn more about the history of black folks. And I rejected the notion that skin color determined intelligence. And so now my dad and I were in many ways at loggerheads because I was coming home to a father lamenting his skin color. At the same time, I'm reveling in the history of folks with my skin color. So it was quite a conflict, and it was a challenge.
But that's not the only time in your family's history that there was a conflict between parent and child, because you write that your father actually wanted to be a professional musician, but his mother insisted that he work for IBM, sacrificing his dream. You also talk about your grandfather sacrificed his dream of being a minister, then a doctor, to work as a porter. So sacrificing your dreams to pursue opportunities that family members may think will make your children or the race better off is sort of one of the running themes in this book.
Oh, it absolutely is. And as I look back, you know, it's not just a running theme for me and my family, but for many African Americans who were the first in this, the first in that, the first in, no, the first black police captain, the first black fire chief, the first black lawyer in a firm. And many of these folks in New York City lived in our neighborhood. So I got to meet them. And I think many of them sacrificed in order to advance other folks forward. I think that's a constant theme you see among African-Americans and minorities who are first in a field, is that they are sacrificing personal goals for a larger sense of what can happen with their children and other members of their community who look like them. I can look back now with a lot of gratitude and thanks, but what I saw growing up really made me chafe a little bit, because I saw what the sacrifice meant in terms of my relationship with my dad, in terms of my parents' marriage. It was not an easy sacrifice to be at the other end of.
One of the interesting things you bring out in the book, you take a look at the history of IBM, and you look at the development of technology, and there was a bright future that IBM and a lot of technology people thought was coming, and that technology would help to address complex social issues like race relations through the use of benevolent digital technology. But you say that now that, you know, technological progress is now a significant barrier to progress in race relations. And you bring up two examples that either I completely forgot about them or was not aware of. And that is how the algorithms, when searching on with these on for using Google and other similar search engines, reflected many instances the racism that was endemic in society. And the example you gave was, there was this professor who was getting information for her stepdaughter and her niece on black young black ladies, and Googled black girls to find information to share with them. And she was shocked by some of the information that was posted on the first page results. And then you tell the other story about a young man who videotaped himself doing a search for three black teenagers and three white teenagers, two separate searches, and how incredibly different the results for those types of searches were. And so you call into question these algorithms, that these algorithms, which represent the frailty of human decisions and the racism that, in my words, at least, that is endemic, perpetuated that, and in some instances may have bring people to questionable websites with questionable theories, but organizations that manipulate the algorithms so that they pop up first.
That's right. And I have to say, that is a tragedy of the digital age, that I think men like my father and his colleagues and the women that worked in the early days of computers to lay the foundations of the internet, the foundations of search engines, I don't think they fully understood the monster that they were creating. Look, those things are still going on even today. I talked about, you know, the pornographic references that came up when black girls were entered into the search engine, as you said, or the young man who, when he searched for black mugshots of criminals, when he searched for white teens, he got these all-American shots. It goes on and on. When Michelle Obama's picture was entered into a Google picture search, what came up were images of gorillas. When you put the term using the N-word first and then house next to that, what you pulled up during Obama's presidency was the White House. There was a Tetris game put out called Slave Tetris, where you had slaves dropping in on a slave ship in order to play this game. I mean, it just goes on and on and on, the number of instances in which the algorithms for both search and entertainment and information retrieval from the internet, because they are written by people, manifest the biases and prejudices and racism that are inherent in the culture that these folks who write the algorithms come from. Most people, Hopeton, as you know, who don't really understand how algorithms are created, somehow, I believe, think that algorithms are these magical entities that drop out of the sky and control how we interact with technology. They're not. As you know, they are actually written by human beings who bring to the table, when they write these algorithms, all of their built-in biases and prejudices. And because there are so few people of color in technology fields helping to design and craft these algorithms, it's like what we used to say in computers: garbage in, garbage out. Racism in, you're going to get racism out on the other end of these algorithms. And that's one of the things that I did want to bring out in the book. I wanted to talk about the examples of that, and also to say that I don't really feel that my father and his colleagues, as I said earlier, really understood the monster they were releasing as they created this digital future that we are now living in.
What recommendations would you make to the technology industry here in Austin, Texas, which is huge, to tackle those issues?
Yeah, so there's a lot of recommendations. One, obviously, you know, go out and find black employees, and there are many. To say that there's a pipeline problem and they don't exist just is not true. All the studies show that there are fewer blacks in high technology positions than ought to be. Make sure that the people who are writing your algorithm go to training where they understand the built-in biases and prejudices that might exist in the code that they create. Test out the products that you develop on groups, on focus groups that are very diverse, that include all sorts of communities, so that when those products are released, they will have been vetted. And if there are any offenses that would happen for a particular group, you will know about them before. For example, Slave Tetris. All you have to do is test out that game on a group of black folks, and you would have known immediately you were releasing a product which is completely offensive. Just following some really standard sensibility guidelines about how you do quality assurance and how you do product development and software development by incorporating people of color at all levels of a corporation, a high-tech corp, that's going to go a long ways, and it's something we don't see happening to the extent that it should.
Clyde W. Ford, author of Think Black. It's a memoir of his tenure and his father's tenure at IBM and the technology industry. Thanks for being a guest on KZL Book Review.
Hopeton, thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate this.
Thanks for listening to this podcast edition of KAZI Book Review. Be sure to like my Facebook page entitled KAZI Book Review, and my Twitter handle is @KAZIBooks, and my Instagram handle is KAZI_book_review. Have a great day.